thought they were better than other people. They're convinced they're so special that they don't need to follow the rules other people have to follow, she said. Like presenting their school records when they enroll in a new school. She looked at me and raised her eyebrows meaningfully. Who thinks that's not fair? She asked the class. All the kids except me raised their hands. I see our new student doesn't agree, she said. Perhaps you'd like to explain yourself? I was sitting in the second-to-last row. The students in front of me swiveled their heads around to stare. I decided to dazzle them with the answer from the Ergo game. Insufficient information to draw a conclusion, I said. Oh, really? Miss Caparossi asked. Is that what they say in a big city like Phoenix? She pronounced it Phoenix. Then she turned to the class and said in a high mocking voice, insufficient information to draw a conclusion. The class laughed violently. I felt something sharp and painful between my shoulder blades and turned around. The tall black girl with the almond eyes was sitting at the desk behind me. Holding up the sharp pencil she jabbed into my back, she smiled the same malicious smile I'd seen in the playground. I looked for Brian in the cafeteria at lunchtime, but fourth graders were on a different schedule. So I sat by myself and bit into the sandwich Irma had made for me that morning. It was tasteless and greasy. I pulled apart the two slices of Wonder Bread. Inside was a thin smear of lard. That was it. No meat, no cheese, not even a slice of pickle. Even so, I chewed slowly, staring intently at my bite marks in the bread to delay as long as possible the moment I would have to leave the cafeteria and go out to the playground. When I was the last student left in the cafeteria, the janitor, who was putting the chairs on the tabletop so the floor could be mopped, told me it was time to go. Outside, a thin mist hung in the still air. I pulled the sides of my lamb's wool coat together. Three black girls, led by the one with the almond eyes, started moving toward me as soon as they saw me. A half dozen other girls followed. Within moments, I was surrounded. You think you're better than us? The tall girl asked. No, I said. I think we're all equal. You think you're as good as me? She punched at me. When, instead of raising my hands in defense, I kept clutching my coat closed, she realized it had no buttons. This girl ain't got no buttons on her coat, she shouted. That seemed to give her the license she needed. She pushed me in the chest, and I fell backward. I tried to get up, but all three girls started kicking me. I rolled away into a puddle, shouting for them to quit and hitting back at the feet coming at me from all sides. The other girls had closed in a circle around us, and none of the teachers could see what was going on. There was no stopping those girls until they'd had their fill. When we got home that afternoon, Mom and Dad were eager to hear about our first day. It was good, I said. I didn't want to tell Mom the truth. I was in no mood to hear one of her lectures about the power of positive thinking. See, she said, I told you you'd fit right in. Brian shrugged off Mom and Dad's questions, and Lori didn't want to talk about her day at all. How were the other kids? I asked her later. Okay, she said, but she turned away, and that was the end of the conversation. The bullying continued every day for weeks. The tall girl, whose name was Denisha Hewitt, watched me with her smile while we all waited on the asphalt playground for classes to start. At lunch, I ate my lard sandwiches with paralytic slowness, but sooner or later, the janitor started putting the chairs up on the tables. I walked outside trying to hold my head high, and Denisha and her gang surrounded me. And it began. As we fought, they called me poor and ugly and dirty, and it was hard to argue the point. I had three dresses to my name, all hand-me-downs or from a thrift store, which meant each week I had to wear two of them twice. They were so worn from countless washings that the threads were beginning to separate. We were also always dirty. Not dry dirty like we'd been in the desert, but grimy dirty and smudged with oily dust from the coal-burning stove. Irma allowed us only one bath a week in 4 inches of water that had been heated on the kitchen stove and that all of us kids had to share. I thought of discussing the fighting with Dad, but I didn't want to sound like a whiner. Also, he'd rarely been sober since we had arrived at Welch, and I was afraid that if I told him, he'd show up at school snockered and make things even worse. I did try to talk to Mom. I couldn't bring myself to tell her about the beatings, fearing that if I did, she'd try to butt in, and she'd also only make things worse. I did say that these three black girls were giving me a hard time because we were so poor. Mom told me I should tell them there was nothing wrong with being poor, that Abraham Lincoln, the greatest president this country had ever seen, came from a dirt-poor family. She also said I should tell them that Martin Luther King Jr. would be ashamed of their behavior. Even though I knew these high-minded arguments would get me nowhere, I tried them anyway. Martin Luther King would be ashamed. And they made the three girls shriek with laughter as they pushed me to the ground. Lying in Stanley's bed at night with Lori, Brian, and Maureen, I concocted revenge scenarios. I imagined myself like Dad in his Air Force days, whooping the entire lot of them. After school, I'd go to the woodpile next to the basement and practice karate chops and drop kicks on the kindling while laying down some pretty wicked cuss words. But I also kept thinking about Denisha, trying to make sense of her. I hoped for a while to befriend her. I'd seen Denisha smile a few times with genuine warmth, and it transformed her face. With a smile like that, she had to have some good in her. But I couldn't figure out how to get her to shine it my way. About a month after I'd started school, I was walking up some steps to a park at the top of a hill when I heard a low, furious barking coming from the other side of the World War I memorial. I ran up the stairs and saw a big, lathered-up mongrel cornering a little black kid of about 5 or 6 against the monument. The kid kept giving kicks at the dog as it barked and lunged at him. The kid was looking over the tree line on the far side of the park, and I could tell he was calculating the chances of making it over there. "Don't run," I shouted. The boy looked up at me. So did the dog, and in that instant, the kid took off in a hopeless dash for the trees. The dog bounded after him, barking, then caught up with him and snapped at his legs. Now, there are mad dogs and wild dogs and killer dogs, and any one of them would go for your throat and hold on until you or it was dead. But I could tell this dog was not truly bad. Instead of tearing into the kid, it was just having fun terrifying him, growling and pulling on his pant leg, but doing no real damage. It was just a mutt who had been kicked around too much and was happy to find a creature who was afraid of it. I picked up a stick and raced toward them. "Go on now," I shouted at the dog. When I raised the stick, it whimpered and slunk off. The dog's teeth had not broken the boy's skin, but his pant leg was torn, and he was trembling as if he had palsy. I offered to take him home, and I ended up carrying him piggyback. He was feather-light. I couldn't get a word out of him except the most minimal directions. "Up there, that way," in a voice I could barely hear. The houses in the neighborhood were old but freshly painted, some in bright colors like lavender or Kelly green. "This here," the boy whispered when we came to a house with blue shutters. It had a neat yard, but was so small that dwarves could have lived there. When I put the kid down, he dashed up the steps and through the door. I turned to go. Denisha Hewitt was standing on the porch across the street, looking at me curiously. The next day, when I went out onto the playground after lunch, the gang of girls started toward me. But Denisha hung back. Without their leader, The others lost their sense of purpose and stopped short of me. The following week, Dinesha asked me for help in an English assignment. She never said she was sorry for the bullying or even mentioned it, but she thanked me for bringing her neighbor home that night, and I figured that her request for help was as close to an apology as I would ever get. Irma had made it clear how she felt about black people, so instead of inviting Dinesha to our house to work on her assignment, I suggested on the upcoming Saturday I'd go to hers. That day I was leaving the house at the same time as Uncle Stanley. He never had the wherewithal to learn to drive, but someone from the appliance store where he worked was picking him up. He asked me if I wanted a ride too. When I told him where I was headed, he frowned. "That's Niggerville," he said. "What you going there for?" Stanley didn't want his friend to drive me there, so I walked. When I got back home later in the afternoon, the house was empty except for Irma, who never set foot outside. She stood in the kitchen, stirring a pot of green beans and taking swigs from the bottle of hooch in her pocket. "So how was Niggerville?" she asked. Irma was always going on about the niggers. Her and Grandpa's house was on Court Street, on the edge of the black neighborhood. It galled her when they started moving into that section of town, and she always said it was their fault that Welch had gone downhill. "When you were sitting in the living room, where Irma always kept the shades drawn, you could hear groups of black people walking into town, talking and laughing." "Goddamn niggers," Irma always muttered. "The reason I have not gone out of this house in 15 years is because I do not want to see or be seen by a nigger." Mom and Dad had always forbidden us to use that word. It was much worse than any curse word, they told us. But since Irma was my grandmother, I never said anything when she used it. Irma kept stirring the beans. "Keep this up, and people are going to think you're a nigger lover," she said. She gave me a serious look, as if imparting a meaningful life lesson I should ponder and absorb. She unscrewed the cap from her bottle of hooch and took a long, contemplative swallow. As I watched her drinking, I felt this pressure building in my chest and had to let it out. "You're not supposed to use that word," I said. Irma's face went slack with astonishment. "Mom says they're just like us," I continued, "except they have different complexions." Irma glared at me. I thought she was going to backhand me, but instead she said, "You ungrateful little shit. I'll be damned if you're eating my food tonight. Get your worthless ass down to the basement." Lori gave me a hug when she'd heard I told off Irma. Mom was upset, though. "We may not agree with all of Irma's views," she said, "but we have to remember that as long as we're her guests, we have to be polite." That didn't seem like Mom. She and Dad happily railed against anyone they disliked or disrespected. Standard Oil executives, J. Edgar Hoover, and especially snobs and racists. They'd always encouraged us to be outspoken about our opinions, but now we were supposed to bite our tongues. But she was right. Irma would boot us. Situations like these, I realized, were what turned people into hypocrites. "I hate Irma," I told Mom. "You have to show compassion for her," Mom said. Irma's parents had died when she was young, Mom explained, and she'd been shipped off to one relative after another who had treated her like a servant. Scrubbing clothes on a washboard until her knuckles bled, that was the preeminent memory of Irma's childhood. The best thing Grandpa did for her when they got married was buy her an electric washing machine. But whatever joy it had once given her was long gone. "Irma can't let go of her misery," Mom said. "It's all she knows." She added that you should never hate anyone, even your worst enemies. "Everyone has something good about them," she said. "You have to find that redeeming quality and love the person for that." "Oh, yeah?" I said. "What about Hitler?" What was his redeeming quality? Hitler loved dogs, Mom said without hesitation. In late winter, Mom and Dad decided to drive the Oldsmobile back to Phoenix. They said they were going to fetch our bikes and all the other stuff we'd had to leave behind, pick up copies of our school records, and see if they could rescue Mom's Fruitwood archery set from the irrigation ditch alongside the road to the Grand Canyon. We kids were to remain in Welch. Since Lori was the oldest, Mom and Dad said she was in charge. Of course, we were all answerable to Irma. They left one morning during a thaw. I could tell by the high color of Mom's cheeks that she was excited about the prospect of an adventure. Dad was also clearly itching to get out of Welch. He had not found a job, and we were dependent on Irma for everything. Lori had suggested that Dad go to work in the mines, but he said the mines were controlled by the unions, and the unions were controlled by the mob, and the mob had blackballed him for investigating corruption in the electricians' union back in Phoenix. Another reason for him to return to Phoenix was to gather his research on corruption, because the only way he could get a job in the mines was by helping reform the United Mine Workers of America. I wished we were all going together. I wanted to be back in Phoenix, sitting under the orange trees behind our adobe house, riding my bike to the library, eating free bananas in a school where the teachers thought I was smart. I wanted to feel the desert sun on my face and breathe in the dry desert air and climb the steep rock mountains where Dad led us on one of the long hikes that he called geological survey expeditions. I asked if we could all go, but Dad said he and Mom were making a quick trip, strictly business, and we kids would only get in the way. Besides, he couldn't go taking us out of school in the middle of the year. I pointed out that it had never bothered him before. Welch wasn't like those other places we had lived, he said. There were rules that had to be followed, and people didn't take it kindly when you flouted them. Do you think they'll come back? Brian asked as Mom and Dad drove off. Of course, I said, though I had been wondering the same thing. These days, we seemed more of an inconvenience than we used to be. Lori was already a teenager, and in a couple of years, Brian and I would be too. They couldn't toss us into the back of a U-Haul or put us in cardboard boxes at night. Brian and I started running after the Oldsmobile. Mom turned once and waved, and Dad stuck his hand out the window. We followed them all the way down Court Street, where they picked up speed and then turned the corner. I had to believe they'd come back, I told myself. If I didn't believe, then they might not return. They might leave us forever. After Mom and Dad left, Irma became even more cantankerous. If she didn't like the look on our faces, she would hit us on the head with a serving spoon. Once she pulled out a framed photograph of her father and told us he was the only person who had ever loved her. She talked on and on about how much she'd suffered as an orphan at the hands of her aunts and uncles, who hadn't treated her half as kindly as she was treating us. About a week after Mom and Dad had left, we kids were all sitting in Irma's living room watching TV. Stanley was sleeping in the foyer. Irma, who'd been drinking since before breakfast, told Brian that his britches needed mending. He started to take them off, but Irma said she didn't want him running around the house in his skivvies or with a towel wrapped around him, looking like he was wearing a goddamn dress. It would be easier for her to mend the britches while he was still wearing them. She ordered him to follow her into Grandpa's bedroom, where she kept her sewing kit. They'd been gone for a minute or two when I heard Brian weakly protesting. I went into Grandpa's bedroom and saw Irma kneeling on the floor in front of Brian, grabbing at the crotch of his pants, squeezing and kneading while mumbling to herself and telling Brian to hold still, goddammit. Brian, his cheeks wet with tears, was holding his hands protectively between his legs. "Irma, you leave him alone!" I shouted. Irma, still on her knees, twisted around and glared at me. "Why, you little bitch," she said. Lori heard the commotion and came running. I told Lori that Irma's touching Brian in a way that she ought not to be. Irma said she was merely mending Brian's inseam and that she shouldn't have to defend herself against some lying little whore's accusations. I know what I saw, I said. She's a pervert. Irma reached over to slap me, but Lori caught her hand. Let's all calm down, Lori said in the same voice she used when Mom and Dad got carried away arguing. Everybody, calm down. Irma jerked her hand out of Lori's grasp and slapped her so hard that Lori's glasses went flying across the room. Lori, who had turned 13, slapped her back. Irma hit Lori again, and this time, Lori struck Irma a blow in the jaw. Then they flew at each other, tussling and flailing and pulling hair locked together, with Brian and me cheering on Lori until we woke up Uncle Stanley, who staggered into the room and pushed them apart. Irma relegated us to the basement after that. A door in the basement led directly outside, so we never went upstairs. We weren't even allowed to use Irma's bathroom, which meant we either had to wait for school or go outside after dark. Uncle Stanley sometimes sneaked down beans he'd boiled for us, but he was afraid if he stayed talking, Irma would think he'd taken our side and get mad at him, too. The following week, a storm hit. The temperature dropped and a foot of snow fell on Welch. Irma wouldn't let us use any coal. She said we didn't know how to operate the stove and would burn the house down. And it was so cold in the basement that Lori, Brian, Maureen, and I were glad we all shared one bed. As soon as we got home from school, we'd climb under the covers with our clothes on and do our homework there. We were in bed the night Mom and Dad came back. We didn't hear the sound of the car pulling up. All we heard was the front door opening upstairs, then Mom and Dad's voices, and Irma beginning the long narrative of her grievances against us. That was followed by the sound of Dad stomping down the stairs into the basement, furious at all of us, me for back-talking Irma and making wild accusations, and Lori even more for daring to strike her own grandmother, and Brian for being such a pussy and starting the whole thing. I thought Dad would come around to our side once he'd heard what happened, and I tried to explain. I don't care what happened, he yelled. But we were just protecting ourselves, I said. Brian's a man. He can take it, he said. I don't want to hear another word of this. Do you hear me? He was shaking his head, but wildly, almost as if he thought he could keep out the sound of my voice. He wouldn't even look at me. After Dad had gone back upstairs to tie into Irma's hooch and we kids were all in bed, Brian bit my toe to try to make me laugh. But I kicked him away. We all lay there in the silent darkness. Dad was really weird, I said, because someone had to say it. You'd be weird, too, if Irma's your mom, Lori said. Do you think she ever did something to Dad like what she did to Brian? I asked. No one said a thing. It was gross and creepy to think about it, but it would explain a lot. Why Dad left home as soon as he could. Why he drank so much and why he got so angry. Why he never wanted to visit Welch when we were younger. Why he at first refused to come to West Virginia with us, and only at the last possible moment overcame his reluctance and jumped into the car. Why he was shaking his head so hard, almost like he wanted to put his hands over his ears when I tried to explain what Irma had been doing to Brian. Don't think about things like that, Lori told me. It'll make you crazy. And so I put it out of my mind. Mom and Dad told us how they'd made it to Phoenix only to find that Mom's laundry on the clothesline ploy hadn't kept out intruders. Our house on North 3rd Street had been looted. Pretty much everything was gone, including, of course, our bikes. Mom and Dad had rented a trailer to carry back what little was left. Mom said those foolish thieves had overlooked some good stuff, such as a pair of Grandma Smith's riding breeches from the 30s that were of the highest quality. But the Oldsmobile's engine had seized up in Nashville, and they had to abandon it along with the trailer and Grandma Smith's riding breeches and take the bus the rest of the way to Welch. I thought that once Mom and Dad returned, they'd be able to make peace with Irma. But she said she could never forgive us kids and didn't want us in her house any longer, even if we stayed in the basement and kept quiet as church mice. We were banished. That was the word Dad used. You did wrong, he said, and now we've all been banished. This isn't exactly the Garden of Eden, Lori said. I was more upset about the bike than I was about Irma banishing us. Why don't we just move back to Phoenix, I asked Mom. We've already been there, she said, and there are all sorts of opportunities here that we don't even know about. She and Dad set out to find us a new place to live. The cheapest rental in Welch was an apartment over a diner in McDowell Street that cost $75 a month, which was out of our price range. Also, Mom and Dad wanted outdoor space we could call our own, so they decided to buy. Since we had no money for a down payment and no steady income, our options were pretty limited. But within a couple of days, Mom and Dad told us they had found a house we could afford. It's not exactly palatial, so there's going to be a lot of togetherness, Mom said. And it's on the rustic side. How rustic? Lori asked. Mom paused. I could see her debating how to phrase her answer. It doesn't have indoor plumbing, she said. Dad was still looking for a car to replace the Olds. Our budget was in the high two figures. So that weekend, we all hiked over for our first look at the new place. We walked down the valley through the center of town and around a mountainside, past the small, tidy brick houses put up after the mines were unionized. We crossed a creek that fed into the Tug River and started up a barely paved one-lane road called Little Hobart Street. We climbed through several switchbacks and, for a stretch, rose at an angle so steep you had to walk on your toes. If you tried walking flat-footed, you stretched your calves till they hurt. The houses up here were shabbier than the brick houses lower in the valley. They were made of wood with lopsided porches, sagging roofs, rusted-out gutters, and balding tar paper or asphalt shingles slowly but surely parting from the underwall. In almost every yard, a mutt or two was chained to a tree or a clothesline post, and they barked furiously as we walked by. Like most houses in Welch, they were heated by coal. The more prosperous families had coal sheds. The poorer ones left their coal in a pile out front. The porches were every bit as furnished as the insides of most houses, with rust-stained refrigerators, folding card tables, hook rugs, couches or car seats for serious porch setting, and maybe a battered armoire with a hole cut in the side so the cat would have a cozy place to sleep. We followed the road almost to the end, where Dad pointed up at our new house. Well, kids, welcome to 93 Little Hobart Street, Mom said. Welcome to home sweet home. We all stared. The house was a dinky thing, perched high up off the road on a hillside so steep that only the back of the house rested on the ground. The front, including a drooping porch, jutted precariously into the air, supported by tall, spindly cinder block pillars. It had been painted white a long time ago, but the paint, where it hadn't peeled off altogether, had turned a dismal gray. It's a good thing we raised you young'uns to be tough, Dad said, because this is not a house for the faint of heart. Dad led us up the lower steps, which were made of rock slapped together with cement. Because of settling and erosion and downright slipshod construction, they tilted dangerously toward the street. Where the stone steps ended, a rickety set of stairs made from 2x4s, more like a ladder than a staircase, took you up to the front porch. Inside were three rooms, each about 10 feet by 10 feet, facing onto the porch. The house had no bathroom, but underneath it, behind one of the cinder block pillars, was a closet-sized room with a toilet on a cement floor. The toilet wasn't hooked up to a sewer or any septic system. It just sat atop a hole about 6 feet deep. There was no running water indoors. A water spigot rose a few inches above the ground near the toilet, so you could get a bucket and tote water upstairs. While the house was wired for electricity, Dad confessed that we could not at the moment afford to have it turned on. On the upside, Dad said, The house cost only $1,000, and the owner had waived the down payment. We were supposed to pay him $50 a month. If we could make the payments on time, we'd own the place outright in under 2 years. "Hard to believe that one day this will all be ours," said Lori. She was developing what Mom called a bit of a sarcastic streak. "Count your blessings," Mom said. "There are people in Ethiopia who would kill for a place like this." She pointed out that the house did have some attractive features. For example, in the living room was a cast-iron pot-bellied coal stove for heating and cooking. It was big and handsome, with heavy bear claw feet, and she was certain it was valuable if you took it to a place where people appreciated antiques. But since the house had no chimney, the stovepipe vented out a back window. Someone had replaced the glass in the upper part of the window with plywood and wrapped tinfoil around the opening to keep the coal smoke from leaking into the room. The tinfoil had not done its job too well, and the ceiling was black with soot. Someone, probably the same someone, had also made the mistake of trying to clean the ceiling in a few spots, but it ended up only smudging and smearing the soot, creating whitish patches that made you realize how black the rest of the ceiling was. "The house itself isn't much," Dad apologized, "but we won't be living in it long. The important thing, the reason he and Mom had decided to acquire this particular piece of property, was that it came with plenty of land to build our new house. He planned to get to work on it right away. He intended to follow the blueprints for the glass castle, but he had to do some serious reconfiguring and increase the size of the solar cells to take into account that since we were on the north face of the mountain and enclosed by hills on both sides, we'd hardly ever get any sun. We moved in that afternoon. Not that there was much to move. Dad borrowed a pickup from the appliance store where Uncle Stanley worked and brought back a sofa bed that a friend of Grandpa's was throwing out. Dad also scavenged a couple of tables and chairs, and he built some makeshift closets, which were actually kind of nifty, by hanging lengths of pipe from the ceiling with wires. Mom and Dad took over the room with the stove, and it became a combined living room, master bedroom, art studio, and writer's study. We put the sofa bed there, though once we opened it, it never went back to being a sofa. Dad built shelves all along the upper walls to store Mom's art supplies. She set up her easel under the stovepipe, right next to the back window, because she said it got natural sunlight, which it did, relatively speaking. She put her typewriters under another window, with shelves for her manuscripts and works in progress, and she immediately started thumbtacking index cards with story ideas to the walls. We kids all slept in the middle room. At first, we shared one big bed that had been left by the previous owner, but Dad decided we were getting a tad old for that. We were also too big to sleep in cardboard boxes, and there wasn't enough room on the floor for them anyway, so we helped Dad build two sets of bunk beds. We made the frames with 2x4s, then we drilled holes in the sides and threaded ropes through. For mattresses, we laid cardboard over the ropes. When we finished, our bunk beds looked sort of plain, so we spray-painted the sides with ornate red and black curlicues. Dad came home with a discarded 4-drawer dresser, 1 drawer for each of us. He also built each of us a wooden box with sliding doors for personal stuff. We nailed them on the wall above our beds, and that was where I kept my geode. The third room at 93 Little Hobart Street, the kitchen, was in a category all its own. It had an electric stove, but the wiring was not exactly up to code, with faulty connectors, exposed lines, and buzzing switches. "Helen Keller must have wired this damned house," Dad declared. He decided it was too convoluted to bother fixing. We called the kitchen the loose juice room because on the rare occasion that we had paid the electricity bill and had power, we'd get a wicked electric shock if we touched any damp or metallic surface in the room. The first time I got zapped, it knocked my breath out and left me twitching on the floor. We quickly learned that whenever we ventured into the kitchen, we needed to wrap our hands in the driest socks or rags we could find. If we got a shock, we'd announce it to everyone else, sort of like giving a weather report. big jolt from touching the stove today, would say, wear extra rags. One corner of the kitchen ceiling leaked like a sieve. Every time it rained, the plasterboard ceiling would get all swollen and heavy, with water streaming steadily from the center of the bulge. During one particularly fierce rainstorm that spring, the ceiling grew so fat it burst, and water and plasterboard came crashing down onto the floor. Dad never repaired it. We kids tried patching the roof on our own with tar paper, tinfoil, wood, and Elmer's glue, but no matter what we did, the water found its way through. Eventually we gave up, so every time it rained outside, it rained in the kitchen too. At first, Mom tried to make living at 93 Little Hobart Street seem like an adventure. The woman who had lived there before us left behind an old-fashioned sewing machine that you operated with a foot treadle. Mom said it would come in handy because we could make our own clothes even when the electricity was turned off. She also claimed you didn't need patterns to sew. You could get creative and wing it. Shortly after we moved in, Mom, Lori, and I measured one another and tried to make our own dresses. It took forever, and they came out baggy and lopsided, with sleeves that were different lengths and armholes in the middle of our backs. I couldn't get mine over my head until Mom snipped out a few stitches. "It's stunning," she said. But I told her I looked like I was wearing a big pillowcase with elephant trunks sticking out of the sides. Lori refused to wear hers outdoors or even indoors, and Mom had to agree that sewing wasn't the best use of our creative energy or our money. The cheapest cloth we could find cost 79 cents a yard, and you needed more than 2 yards for a dress. It made more sense to buy thrift store clothes, and they had the armholes in the right places. Mom also tried to make the house cheerful. She decorated the living room walls with her oil paintings, and soon every square inch was covered, except for the space above her typewriter reserved for index cards. We had vivid desert sunsets, stampeding horses, sleeping cats, snow-covered mountains, bowls of fruits, blooming flowers, and portraits of us kids. Since Mom had more paintings than we had wall space, Dad nailed long shelf brackets to the wall, and she hung one picture in front of another until they were 3 or 4 deep. Then she'd rotate the paintings. "Just a little redecorating to perk the place up," she'd say. But I believe she thought of her paintings as children and wanted them to feel that they were all being treated equally. Mom also built rows of shelves in the windows and arranged brightly colored bottles to catch the light. "Now it looks like we have stained glass," she announced. It did, sort of, but the house was still cold and dank. Every night for the first few weeks, lying on my cardboard mattress and listening to the sound of rainwater dripping in the kitchen, I dreamed of the desert and the sun and the big house in Phoenix with the palm tree in the front and the orange trees and oleanders in the back. We had owned that house outright. Still owned it, I kept thinking. It was ours, the one true home we'd ever had. "Are we ever going home?" I asked Dad one day. "Home? Phoenix. This is home now." Seeing as how Welch was our new home, Brian and I figured we'd make the best of it. Dad had shown us the spot near the house where he was going to put the foundation and basement for the glass castle. He measured it off and marked it with stakes and string. Since Dad was hardly ever home, he was out making contacts and investigating the UMW, he told us. And he never got around to breaking ground. Brian and I decided to help. We found a shovel and pickaxe at an abandoned farm and spent just about every free minute digging a hole. We knew we had to dig it big and deep. "No point in building a good house unless you put down the right foundation," Dad always said. It was hard work, but after a month we'd dug a hole deep enough for us to disappear in. Even though we hadn't squared the edges or smoothed the floor, we were still pretty darn proud of ourselves. Once Dad had poured the foundation, we could help him on the frame. But since we couldn't afford to pay the town's trash collection fee, our garbage was really piling up. One day, Dad told us to dump it in the hole. "But that's for the glass castle," I said. "It's a temporary measure," Dad told me. He explained that he was going to hire a truck to cart the garbage to the dump all at once. But he never got around to that either. And as Brian and I watched, the hole for the glass castle's foundation slowly filled with garbage. Around that time, probably because of all the garbage, a big, nasty-looking river rat took up residence at 93 Little Hobart Street. At first, I saw him in the sugar bowl. This rat was too big to fit into an ordinary sugar bowl, but since Mom had a powerful sweet tooth, putting at least 8 teaspoons in a cup of tea, we kept our sugar in a punch bowl on the kitchen table. This rat was not just eating the sugar. He was bathing in it, wallowing in it, positively luxuriating in it, his flickering tail hanging over the side of the bowl, flinging sugar across the table. When I saw him, I froze, then backed out of the kitchen. I told Brian, and we opened the kitchen door cautiously. The rat had climbed out of the sugar bowl and leapt onto the stove. We could see his teeth marks on the pile of potatoes, our dinner, on a plate on the stove. Brian threw the cast iron skillet at the rat. It hit him and clanged on the floor, but instead of fleeing, the rat hissed at us as if we were the intruders. We ran out of the kitchen, slammed the door, and stuffed rags in the gap beneath it. That night, Maureen, who was 5, was too terrified to sleep. She kept on saying that the rat was coming to get her. She could hear it creeping nearer and nearer. I told her to stop being such a wuss. "I really do hear the rat," she said. "I think he's close to me." I told her she was letting fear get the best of her. And since this was one of those times that we had electricity, I turned on the light to prove it. There, crouching on Maureen's lavender blanket, a few inches away from her face, was the rat. She screamed and pushed off her covers, and the rat jumped to the floor. I got a broom and tried to hit the rat with a handle, but it dodged me. Brian grabbed a baseball bat, and we maneuvered it, hissing and snapping into a corner. Our dog, Tinkle, the part Jack Russell Terrier who had followed Brian home one day, caught the rat in his jaws and banged it on the floor until it was dead. When Mom ran into the room, Tinkle was strutting around, all pumped up like the proud beast slayer that he was. Mom said she felt a little sorry for the rat. "Rats need to eat too," she pointed out. "Even though it was dead, it deserved a name," she went on, so she christened it Rufus. Brian, who had read that primitive warriors placed the body parts of their victims on stakes to scare off their enemies, hung Rufus by the tail from a poplar tree in front of our house the next morning. That afternoon, we heard the sound of gunshots. Mr. Freeman, who lived next door, had seen the rat hanging upside down. Rufus was so big, Mr. Freeman thought he was a possum, went and got his hunting rifle, and blew him clean away. There was nothing left of Rufus but a mangled piece of tail. After the Rufus incident, I slept with a baseball bat in my bed. Brian slept with a machete in his. Maureen could barely sleep at all. She kept dreaming she was being eaten by rats, and she used every excuse she could to spend the night at friends' houses. Mom and Dad shrugged off the Rufus incident. They told us we had done battle with fiercer adversaries in the past, and that we would again someday. "What are we going to do about the garbage pit?" I asked. "It's almost filled up." "Enlarge it," Mom said. "We can't keep dumping garbage out there," I said. "What are people going to think?" "Life's too short to worry about what other people think," Mom said. "Anyway, they should accept us for who we are." I was convinced that people might be more accepting of us if we made an effort to improve the way 93 Little Hobart Street looked. There were plenty of things we could do, I felt, that would cost almost nothing. Some people around Welch cut tires into 2 semicircles, painted them white, and used them as edging for their gardens. Maybe we couldn't afford to build a glass castle quite yet, but certainly we could put painted tires around our front yard to spruce it up. It would make us fit in a little bit, I pleaded with Mom.
It sure would, Mom said.
But when it came to Welch, she had no interest in fitting in. I'd rather have a yard filled with genuine garbage than with trashy lawn ornaments. I kept looking for other ways to make improvements. One day, Dad brought home a 5-gallon can of house paint left over from some job he'd worked on. The next morning, I pried the can open. It was nearly full of bright yellow paint. Dad had brought home some paintbrushes, too. A layer of yellow paint, I realized, would completely transform our dingy gray house. It would look, at least from the outside, almost like the houses other people lived in. I was so excited by the prospect of living in a perky yellow home that I could barely sleep that night. I got up early the next day and tied my hair back, ready to begin the house painting. If we all work together, we can get it done in a day or two, I told everyone. But Dad said 93 Little Hobart Street was such a dump that we shouldn't waste time or energy on it that we could be devoting to the glass castle. Mom said she thought bright yellow houses were tacky. Brian and Lori said we didn't have the ladders and scaffolding we needed. Dad was making no visible progress on the glass castle, and I knew that the can of yellow paint would sit on the porch unless I undertook the job myself. I'd borrow a ladder, or make one, I decided. I was certain that once everyone saw the amazing transformation of the house begin, they'd all join in. Out on the porch, I opened the can and stirred the paint with a stick, blending in the oil that had risen to the surface until the paint, which was the color of buttercups, had turned creamy. I dipped in a fat brush and spread the paint along the old clapboard siding in long, smooth strokes. It went on bright and glossy and looked even better than I'd hoped. I started on the far side of the porch, around the door that went into the kitchen. In a few hours, I had covered everything that could be reached from the porch. Parts of the front were still unpainted, and so were the sides, but I had used less than a quarter of the paint. If everyone else helped, we could paint all the areas I couldn't reach, and in no time, we would have a cheerful yellow house. But neither Mom nor Dad, nor Brian, nor Lori, nor Maureen was impressed. So part of the front of the house is yellow now, Lori said. That's really going to turn things around for us. I was going to have to finish the job myself. I tried to make a ladder from bits of scrap wood, but it kept collapsing whenever I put my weight on it. I was still trying to build a sturdy ladder when, during a cold snap a few days later, my can of paint froze solid. When it got warm enough for the paint to thaw, I opened the can. During the freeze, the chemicals had separated, and the once smooth liquid was as lumpy and runny as curdled milk. I stirred it as hard as I could and kept stirring even after I knew the paint was ruined, because I knew that we'd never get more. And instead of a freshly painted yellow house, or even a dingy gray one, we now had a weird-looking half-finished patch job, one that announced to the world that the people inside the house wanted to fix it up, but lacked the gumption to get the work done. Little Hobart Street led up into one of those hollows so deep and narrow that people joked you had to pipe in the sunlight. The neighborhood did have a lot of kids. Maureen had real friends for the first time, and we all tended to hang out at the National Guard Armory at the foot of the hill. The boys played tackle football on the training field. Most of the girls my age spent their afternoons sitting on the brick wall surrounding the armory, combing their hair and touching up their lip gloss, and pretending to get all indignant, but secretly loving it if a crew-cut reservist wolf-whistled at them. One of the girls, Cindy Thompson, made a special effort to befriend me. But it turned out that what she really wanted was to recruit me for the Junior Ku Klux Klan. Neither putting on makeup nor wearing a sheet had much appeal for me. So I played football with the boys, who would waive their guys-only rule and let me join a team if they were short a player. The better-off folk of Welch had not exactly flocked to our part of town.
A few miners lived along the street, but most of the grown-ups didn't work at all. Some of the moms had no husbands, and some of the dads had black lung. The rest were either too distracted by their troubles or just plain unmotivated, so pretty much everyone grudgingly accepted some form of public aid. Although we were the poorest family on Little Hobart Street, Mom and Dad never applied for welfare or food stamps, and they always refused charity. When teachers gave us bags of clothes from church drives, Mom made us take them back. "We can take care of our own," Mom and Dad liked to say. "We don't accept handouts from anyone." If things got tight, Mom kept reminding us that some of the other kids on Little Hobart Street had it tougher than we did. The 12 Grady kids had no dad. He'd either died in a mine cave in a runoff with a whore, depending on whom you listened to, and their mom spent her days in bed suffering from migraines. As a result, the Grady boys ran completely wild. It was hard to tell them apart because they all wore blue jeans and torn t-shirts and had their heads shaved bald to keep away lice. When the oldest boy found their dad's pump-action shotgun under their mom's bed, he decided to get in some target practice on Brian and me, firing buckshot as we ran for our lives through the woods. And then there were the Halls. All six of the Hall children had been born mentally retarded, and although they were now middle-aged, they all still lived at home with their mom and dad. When I was friendly to the oldest, Kenny Hall, who was 42, he developed a powerful crush on me. The other kids in the neighborhood teased Kenny by telling him that if he gave them a dollar or stripped down to his skivvies and showed them his wanker, they'd arrange for me to go on a date with him. On a Saturday night, if he'd been set up like that, he'd come stand on the street in front of our house, sobbing and hollering about me not keeping our date, and I'd have to go down and explain to him that the other kids had played a trick on him and that, although he did have many admirable qualities, I had a policy against dating older men. The family who had it the toughest on Little Hobart Street, I would have to say, was the Pastors. Their mother, Jenny Sue Pastor, was the town whore. Jenny Sue was 33 years old and had 8 daughters and 1 son. Their names all ended with Y. Her husband, Clarence Pastor, had black lung and sat on the front porch of their huge sagging house all day long. But he never smiled or waved at passers-by. Just sat there like he was frozen. Everyone in town said he'd been impotent for years and none of the Pastor kids was his. Jenny Sue Pastor pretty much kept to herself. At first, I wonder if she lay around in a lacy negligee all day, smoking cigarettes and waiting for gentlemen callers. Back in Battle Mountain, the women lounging on the front porch of the Green Lantern, I'd long since figured out what they really did, wore white lipstick and black mascara and partially unbuttoned blouses that showed off the tops of their brassieres. But Jenny Sue Pastor didn't look like a whore. She was a blousy woman with dyed yellow hair, and from time to time we saw her out in the front yard, chopping wood or filling a scuttle from the coal pile. She usually wore the same kinds of aprons and canvas farm coats worn by the rest of the women on Little Hobart Street. She looked like any other mom. I also wondered how she did all that horn with all those kids to look after. One night, I saw a car pull up in front of the Pastor house and blink its headlights twice. After a minute, Jenny Sue came running out the door and climbed into the front seat. Then the car drove off. Kathy was Jenny Sue Pastor's oldest daughter. The other kids treated her like a total pariah, crowing that her mother was a whore and calling her lice girl. Truth was, she did have a pretty advanced case of head lice. She kept trying to befriend me. One afternoon, on the way home from school, when I told her we lived in California for a while, she lit up. She said her mama had always wanted to go there. She asked if maybe I'd come over to her place and tell her mama all about life in California. Of course I went. I'd never gotten inside the Green Lantern, but now I'd get a close-up look at a genuine prostitute. There were lots of things I wanted to know. Was whoring easy money? Was it ever any fun, or was it just gross? Did Kathy and her sisters and her father all know Jenny's Sioux pastor was a whore? What did they think of it? I didn't plan on flat out asking these questions, but I did think that by getting inside the pastor's house and meeting Jenny Sioux, I'd come away with some idea of the answers. Clarence Pastor, sitting on the porch, ignored Kathy and me as we walked by. Inside, there were all these tiny rooms connected together like boxcars. Because of the way the house was settling on the eroded hillside, the floors and ceilings and windows tilted at different angles. There were no paintings on the walls, but the pastors had taped up pictures of smartly dressed women torn from Sears Roebuck catalogs. Kathy's little sister scampered around noisily, half-dressed. None of them looked alike. One was red-headed, one a blonde, one had black hair, and they were all different shades of brown. Sweet Nan, the youngest, crawled along the living room floor, sucking on a fat dill pickle. Jenny Sioux Pastor sat at the table in the kitchen. Her elbow was in the carcass of a big, expensive roaster, the kind we could hardly ever afford. She had a tired, lined face, but her smile was cheerful and open. "Pleased to meet you," she said to me, wiping her hands on a shirt tail. "We ain't used to getting visitors." Jenny Sioux offered us seats at the table. She had heavy breasts that swayed when she moved, and her blonde hair was dark at the roots. "Y'all help me with this bird, and I'll fix you a couple of Jenny Sioux's special chicken rolls." She turned to me. "You know how to pick a chicken clean?" "I sure do," I said. I hadn't had anything to eat all day. "Well, show me then," Jenny Sioux said. I went for a wing first, pulling apart the spindly double bones and getting all the meat trapped there. Then I set to work on the leg and the thigh bones, snapping them at the joints and pulling off the tendons and digging at the marrow. Kathy and Jenny Sioux were also working on the bird, but soon they stopped to watch me. From the tail, I pull that nice bit of meat that everybody misses. I turn the carcass upside down and scrape off the jellied fat and meat flecks with my fingernails. I stuck my arm elbow deep into the bird to excavate any meat clinging to the rib cage. "Girl," Jenny Sioux said, "in all my days, I have never seen no one pick a chicken clean like you." I held up the spear-shaped cartilage in the breastbone, which most people don't eat, and bit down with a satisfying crunch. Jenny Sioux scraped the meat into a bowl, mixed it with mayonnaise and cheese whiz, then crushed a handful of potato chips and added them. She spread the mixture onto two slices of Wonder Bread, then rolled each slice into a cylinder and passed them to us. "Birds in a blanket," she said. They tasted great. "Mama, Jeanette lived in California," Kathy said. "That's so," Jenny Sioux said. "Live in California and be a stewardess. That was my dream," she sighed. "Never got beyond Bluefield." I told her and Kathy about life in California. It quickly became clear they had no interest in desert mining towns, so I told them about San Francisco, and then about Las Vegas, which wasn't exactly in California, but they didn't seem to care. I made the days we spent there seem like years, and the showgirls I'd seen from a distance seem like close friends and neighbors. I described the glittering casinos and the glamorous high rollers, the palm trees and the swimming pools, the hotels with ice-cold air conditioning, and the restaurants where hostesses with long white gloves lit flaming desserts. "It don't get no better than that," Jenny Sioux said. "No, ma'am, it sure don't," I told her. Sweet Man came in crying, and Jenny Sioux picked him up and let him suck some mayonnaise off her finger. "You did good on that bird," Jenny Sioux told me. "You strike me as the kind of girl who's one day going to be eating roast chicken and those on-fire desserts just as much as you want." She winked. It was only on my way home that I realized I hadn't gotten answers to any of my questions. While I was sitting there talking to Jenny Sioux, I'd even forgotten she was a whore. One thing about whoring, and put a chicken on the table.
We fought a lot in Welsh. Not just if it